Hello, Infants on Thrones listeners. This is Randy. This podcast was recorded a couple of months ago and includes me, John Hamer, and my older brother, Jimmy. In this podcast, we talk about theology, philosophy, and community, among other things. My goal was to bring together two minds that I greatly respect that come from apparently different approaches to these issues, and what I found was an interesting discussion where common ground was found more often than not, which I found interesting. But very recently, and a couple of months after this was recorded, my brother Jimmy's wife died suddenly in her sleep. She was the love of his life and had an amazing mind. Her name is Heather Keel. She kept her maiden name because even as a true believer and as the daughter of a BYU professor, she was a fierce champion of women's rights to equality back as early as the early 1990s. So I want to dedicate this podcast to the memory of my sister-in-law, Heather. Her memory will live on in the many lives she touched with her humanitarian spirit, compassion, intellect, and fight for social justice.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
I have wanted for a long time to get you two guys together in a conversation. John, like, since shortly before you became a PERMA panelist, you and I became friends and started to have these long conversations on the phone. And they were always these really interesting, deep conversations about philosophy and politics. Sometimes we talk about infants, but mostly, you know, the infants was a minor part of the conversations that we'd have.
It's mostly just complaining about Glenn.
Yeah, mostly that, yeah. That's how he talks. Yeah, talking shit about Glenn. And if you've listened to my conversation or our podcast with my brother in the past, you know that we have a close relationship since I left the church. My brother is trained in philosophy. John Hamer is trained in history. And so they're two really interesting, knowledgeable people to talk to. And lately, if you listen to our Sunstone presentation, Glenn was interested in John hosting his sermons, just as minisodes. But I think John and I both thought it'd be more interesting for John to talk in a more in-depth level about what it is that he's all about. But I also wanted to bring my brother on to be kind of the
philosophical watchman.
Yeah.
You know, who's
the
saying, wait a second here, John. You're giving me a bunch of bull, and you know, I don't know, and I can't call you on it because you just swapped into Latin and Greek, and
yeah.
Now I'm feeling intimidated. But my brother knows those languages, and he's gonna whop your ass, and he's gonna. You don't really know anything about philosophy, Hamer. You're just a historian, damn you.
That's not how I conceived of it. I thought it would just be really interesting for us both to explore, given you know, our diverse backgrounds and experience.
Oh, that's what I think, yeah, too. I'm saying that this is what Randy thinks.
Yeah. No, this is what Randy thinks. Like, yeah. He'll show you.
No. That wasn't my feeling. My feeling was John Hamer has left the Mormon Church, just like Jimmy, and John Hamer has landed in a place that, you know, it is. I mean, John, would you disagree? It's a religious place. I know it's not.
Yeah, it's a religion.
Yes. So John has landed in a religious place, but it's a very thoughtful religious place that I respect. And Jimmy left the Mormon Church, and both of you guys left the church about the same time. Jimmy's a little bit older. You're almost 50.
But I'm 45, so round up, I'm pretty close to.
Yeah.
I left in 1991, October.
And I left in 88. So, yeah, it's been a long, long time.
Yeah, the difference was Jimmy went on a mission. Hamer figured it out before then.
Point for Hamer.
Yeah. Hamer one, Jimmy zero. Hamer was still a teenager when he figured out it was all bullshit. But then Jimmy has, you know, he left Mormonism and then jumped immediately into the philosophical world. And, yeah, although you don't like to be called atheist, Jimmy, because of for specific reasons we can talk about later, but
I don't mind being called atheist. Well, I'll explain later in a second.
Yeah. So you're more the materialist end of the spectrum, but it's also a very thoughtful place. And I just thought it would be interesting. This isn't like a debate. It's, I just thought it'd be interesting to have both perspectives. Not like bringing, you know, bringing like a tough guy that you knew from one part of your life a tough guy you knew from the other. And let's just see who's the toughest.
I was teasing you.
But, you know, every time I see your guys' name on my phone, they're calling in, I have to like evaluate my situation on my day to find out if I got it, you know, 2 or 3 hours to talk. And so it's awesome to have you guys finally both together to talk about some of the things that are important to both of you. And so the foundation I want to start this conversation on is, and we're going to start with Jimmy and John can chime in. But since Jimmy is the trained philosopher, what are the issues and the questions that religion and philosophy attempt to address as far as the human condition?
All right. Well, I mean, for me, one of the things I want to mention is that there is, like in philosophy, this whole sub-discipline called philosophy of religion that, for me, is mostly a waste of time. And so something that I've never really been that interested in. But if you go online, you can see, you know, some big names, and what they really do is they argue about certain things. I mean, it's not entirely a waste of time. I've learned a lot from it, I have to say. But where they argue about, you know, arguments for the existence of God. They might talk about the status of religious experience as some sort of warrant for, you know, belief in God. Things along those lines, epistemology of religion, so on and so forth. And that's not really where I find the interest and never have. In fact, it's kind of like back to the good old days of the scholastics where they would argue about the fine points of, you know, basically how many angels can get on a pin of a head, that sort of stuff. And so for me, I think the way to understand, I mean, there is within philosophy and the history of philosophy a whole tradition of raising questions. It goes all the way back to Plato and Aristotle, well, even before then. You know, you might have heard of names like Epicurus and the Stoics and the Skeptics and, you know, things like that. Well, that's where the question is, you know, how's a person to live? You know, that's the question the Greeks were always asking, you know, how should I live? And once you leave the Mormon church, or like a friend of mine a coworker that I just met, actually, who just left an evangelical religion, and her brother did too after going to Fuller Theological Seminary, and here they are kind of adrift, you know, they're away from their home situation, and now they're kind of out in the world trying to figure out how to live, how, you know, and you've got all of these pressing problems that are part of the human condition that your religion and religion in general has, you know, given you answers to, or at least an orientation towards. Things like, you know, what about this fact that I'm going to die? What about the fact that I keep on messing up? What about the possibility of living a life where I'm flourishing? How do I relate to the people around me who are sometimes difficult? How do I know how to evaluate myself? What kind of self-knowledge do I have to bring to this stuff? Is there some sort of way to relate to something transcendent, some sort of, you know, so on and so forth? All those issues that, like, in an ordinary life, the press on you, and you can't avoid, and they're important. And
did you mention tragedy and...
Tragedy, like, for instance, things like having a child of yours die too young, or, you know, even just the small vicissitudes, I mean, well, not small, but I mean, big issues like, you know, aging, disease, You know, mom, for example, dying at 53 of cancer, just horrifically, or, you know, how do I help someone who's suffering from deep mental illness? What's the appropriate way to respond to someone like that? You know, and how do I relate to art now? You know, how do I relate to film? How do I, you know, you've got that whole dimension of life. Let's just put it in that sense of like, you've got problems of knowledge, you've got problems of how to treat other people, you got problems of how to shape your life as wisely as possible. You've got, you know, issues of, you know, the basically the true, the good, and the beautiful, all of those sort of things. How am I going to live, right?
Right.
And so there's a whole history of philosophy dealing with that question, and there are ways of responding to it in interesting ways that I think come out of philosophy, but philosophy always against a backdrop of like knowing our history, knowing our current condition nowadays, and in a hugely secular world, a world with science in it, you know, a new sense of cosmology, you know, the fact that we're not the center of the universe, all of those sort of things that are part of the historical backdrop also, you know, become a part of the issue. Did any of that make sense?
None of it did. It was totally incoherent.
Okay, that's what I thought. That's what it felt like to me.
But in terms of all of those questions, so if we're doing it, approaching it from a coming from a LDS perspective, so when you've been a believing Mormon and you have just kind of bought into all of the very simple answers that Mormonism provides. So as a religion, Mormonism is a fundamentalist religion, a literalistic religion that is actually very excited about being able to have very simple answers to like giant life issues, right? And so that's almost like the quintessential missionary pitch. You know, did you ever wonder why you,
yeah,
you know, where you came from, why you're here, and where you're going, and this kind of thing? And we've got like a three-page flip chart that explains it, or whatever, right? And so yeah, so you have a religion that is operating at this very you know, absurdly reductionistic level, and so that's presumably the prism through which all of the people that are coming, that are both in there and that are coming out of there, are kind of seeing all of these massive life issue questions that Jim is talking about, you know. And then when you are outside of that, the problem with it is that you don't have any apparatus for how do you address all of those things. You used to have a real simple answer. How nice was that? But in a way, that simple answer also trivialized the entire experience. And so maybe it also wasn't satisfying to you, and maybe that's one of the reasons why you left, right?
Yeah, and there are, I mean, there's some other social reasons, Jimmy, that you mentioned to me last time we talked about the social structure, the lay ministry that is problematic. You want to expound on that?
Well, one of the things that Mormonism kind of really fails to do and makes it seem like it's not a very interesting tradition, I think John and I agree that it's just really not one of the first-rate religious traditions out there. It's you know, and it provides meaning for people. I'm not going to denigrate it entirely. But one of the things that it does is it doesn't do anything at all anymore that makes it so people don't identify with, you know, certain basic features of the world, like, you know, it's better to be upper middle class than it is to be working class. That, you know, you can tell who's good by what they do in this checklist that we have, that, you know, there's not much of an emphasis on that elements in the Gospels of the first will be last and the last will be first. And part of that, I think, is just sociological. I don't know if it's intrinsic to Mormonism, as if there were anything intrinsic. It's that we have a lay ministry. And basically everyone is kind of arranged in this hierarchy where you're chosen for your so-called leadership ability, and the higher you get, the more presumably you're spiritual. Certainly you've made it through the checklist of like being worthy for a temple recommend, but also you've been vetted for things that people don't think about, like, are you educated? Are you leadership material? On my mission, we're constantly looking for leadership material in Ecuador, right? And so there ends up being this implicit thing where basically the sort of way in which ordinary status happens in America ends up being the sort of thing that you identify with spirituality. And so it gets everything backwards, and it reflects like no knowledge whatsoever of the Gospels, right? And it also makes it really hard for working class or service class people, people that are non-college educated, to feel fully comfortable in the church.
Conversely, for college educated people, the literalism also has disconnects, right?
Well, but I would argue that most college-educated Mormons aren't educated. They are professionally educated, right?
Okay, sure.
Dentists.
Yeah, like dentists or engineers. Like our father, Randy, and I have a father who has a master's degree in engineering who is like, you know, I mean, I felt like I was deprived horribly of culture growing up. You know, I thought he was a good father, and I'm glad that he wanted me to go to college, but he didn't know anything. And literalism came easy to him.
Yeah, well, literalism speaks to a lot of people because it's simple. It's they can sleep at night, you know, knowing they have the answers. But getting back to what John said, you know, when you have these simple answers and you have a real tragedy like your mother dying when you're 21 years old, and people come up with these trivial, oh, she was needed more on the other side. You want to punch them in the face, you know. It doesn't deal with all of the emotional feelings that you're going through and then the complexity of the issue. And it's very unsatisfying when they're thrown at your face when you're in the midst of something like that.
Right.
For example, it doesn't really get to like the how shattering it can be or how inadequate you can feel in relationship to it, right? It's like this huge, big thing, and now there's an answer, and you better just, you know, get with the program and understand it, right? And because there's an answer, and, you know, you're going to see them and blah, 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 but like they died. They're gone.
Right.
You know, that's huge. I'm not big enough for this.
And thinking about, you know, a 14-year-old sister that doesn't have a mother and really didn't have a mother for years before that. So it's like she didn't have a mother since she was like 8. And not the mother that we enjoyed, but the problem with this is the answer, get with the program, is then you start to think, well, if this answer isn't satisfying to me, then it must be me that's got the problem.
Like right after one of the school shootings or something, you know, which happen all the time, sadly, in
America,
in the United States. But anyway, right after one of those, I had to give a sermon, and the actual topic in the lectionary, you know, from World Church, from the Community of Christ Churches, was God cares for that week.
Okay, you know? And one thing I have to say is that I bet you there's no one in who's an ex-LDS person and knows what a lectionary is.
Yeah, so I have to remember the word myself because it's alien to me. But anyway, lectionary. So the lectionary is a thing that Christian denominations, especially progressive or liberal Christian denominations who are ecumenical together, they are, in the course of a 3-year process, they're more or less reading the Bible over, you know, and in church more or less together, and you are more or less doing sermons and other readings of scripture, you know, every week, and you have like a particular topic, and then there'll be like something from the Gospels, something from the rest of the New Testament, something from the Old Testament, and then in Community of Christ, something from the DNC, something from the Book of Mormon, that are also a scripture that relate to the theme, you know? Anyway, so the theme was God cares, and this was like just a, I thought a, I don't know, I thought it was a just a horrific, a horrific theme, you know, given the week, you know, and what had happened, you know? And so what I did was I had a sermon that was where I kind of did. I said, like, here are five different pat answers that we can find in scripture for the problem of evil. You know, that where we can just explain away suffering and all of these horrible things. You know, and it's in this part of Job we have this one. In this part of Job we have that one. You know, in this part of the Mosiah we have this one. Right. So there's all of these different competing answers that are not the same answer. And when a friend of mine who was attending, he's saying, at a certain point, he thought, okay, I know where you're kind of going. You're leading everybody into, you know, into this. It's a very gloomy sermon. the sermon's going very gloomy. And he's like, but he's gonna pull it out. All right, at the end, he's gonna, you know, it's gonna be like a, you know, like that. You know, at the end,
you're gonna resolve it.
I'm gonna resolve it. And then he's like, and then you didn't resolve it, because what I said at the end was, look, I could tell you, you know, my own, you know, pet ideas and how, you know, I kind of feel like what we can do about suffering and where we can approach it and things like that. But there isn't an answer to this issue, and none of these answers are satisfactory, because if we were to decide that any of these answers were satisfactory, we would really be trivializing all of the suffering that all of these people are going through, you know. So anyway, so that's how my church is.
Well, that actually gets back to one of those key issues that, you know, those problems of life, right? One of the problems is the problem of gratuitous suffering, or at least apparently right. gratuitous suffering.
Sure.
And you know, even within the Christian tradition, there are people that argue, a guy named Tilly, a couple of other people, that the whole notion of explaining or justifying God's ways to human beings when it comes to the real problems of deep suffering is impious. And that basically what it does is it just leads us precisely to what John said. It trivializes suffering. It grants meaning to it when we don't know what the meaning is, or I would say we, you know, if there's meaning, right. But you know, people do seek that out. And I mean, I would say that John's sermon, probably as your friend described it, like ended with, and as Nietzsche says, God's dead. You know? Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like we want an answer, and you know, that's a natural thing. But I think that it's a really dangerous tendency to want to confer meaning on apparently gratuitous and especially tremendously horrific suffering. Because then you've just kind of reduced their suffering to that, you know, place in that story of meaning.
Exactly.
There was something else you mentioned to me, Jimmy, about the Mormon culture, the status thing. I mean, you touched on it with education, but like, so one of the things that bugs me about the Mormon church is all the outward appearances or the outward indicators of status. Like, I made the mistake of when I first graduated from ortho school, the first Sunday I went to church in a suit. And I was immediately called as the high priest group leader.
Yes. It's like, well, especially if they found out that you were, you know, on your way to professional, you know.
Yeah. Prosper.
And, well, I mean, there's a couple of things with respect to that. One of them is what are called axial religions or post-axial religions, where there was a certain time period, you know, in basically the millennium before Christ, where a lot of what we, you know, call the major religions, you know, everything from, you know, Buddhism, Confucianism, and it doesn't even have to be religions, you know, Socrates in the Greek tradition, you know, Taoism in China, Christianity, Judaism, I'm leaving something out, I'm sure, Islam, Hinduism.
Oh, poor Islam.
All of
Islam.
Those major.
Yeah. You forgot Papua New Guinea.
Well, yeah, they're pre-axial, dude.
Sorry. Dude.
The thing is that the one of the things that was introduced by almost all of those traditions was a distance between your conception of things religiously and society, in your society, right? There's a sort of like ability to, you know, take a step back and like really question, have even a quarrel with the cosmos and life, and say, look, we've got a way of repairing that. So, you know, in Buddhism, like one of the things you're taught is not to get absorbed into status, right? And Christ, you know, or you talk about the Hebrew prophets. I mean, there's this like constant tradition of questioning status and trying to overturn ordinary ways of understanding who's great and all that. And of course, it was a mixed bag. But that is one thing that you find in the Gospels, right?
All of those being reforms of the kind of religion that existed before, which were very pro-status. In other words, every single one of those religions is a counter-revolution, you know, to including the Greek philosophy to the pagan style or whatever, polytheistic style religions that are in front of that, where it's all about, you know, if you do this and that and the other thing, you've done the whole the tick list, then that means you're going to be blessed. And so, and because you're blessed, you have that status. So the very primitive kind of religion is you do this, that, and the other thing, God blesses you. And the fact that you're blessed is a sign that you did it all.
Well, one of the ways to look at it is that, you know, and I would dispute some parts of how you said it, just in terms of the primitive. I think that it can get interesting. But I think that there are distinctions between, like, you know, what's going on in Papua New Guinea, if a group of people are religious, and what's going on, say, in Egypt in 3000 BC, right? But the basic point is, though, that it's like ordinary human, flourishing is what's at stake. What's your status? Is it high? Are you fertile? Are you having kids? Are you prospering? Is there drought? All of the sort of things that really, once you start with like Buddhism, Christianity, just to give two examples, you start questioning that, and there's a kind of transcendent good that's outside of it that would overturn the ordinary regime. And the Mormon Church really doesn't do that very well, and it ignores it. And so status, whether it's within the church, I mean, this lay clergy and this emphasis on, you know, leadership material makes it so that status really matches our ordinary, like, desire for being affluent, attractive, and, you know, all of the other things that
– Tall. Don't forget tall.
Tall. Yeah. Do you look like a stake president? Awesome.
Yeah, and the funny thing to me is growing up Mormon a lot longer than both you assholes. It took me into my 30s to figure it out, but they give lip service to things like, oh, in every ward the primary teacher is just as important as the bishop. Yet we don't call the bishop Dave, you know, we call him Bishop, you know. And we call the primary teacher Phil or Phyllis, you know, depending on who it is. But they give lip service to it, but really it the way it shakes out is that you, as a lay clergy, you rise up out of your community as a higher status than other people. That's just the way it's set up. Like when you contrast that with like the Catholic Church, you know, the priest really isn't integrated into the society, into the community, like the bishop is. You know, the bishop came out of
like the
general community.
Like the LDS bishop.
Yes, the LDS bishop, not the Catholic bishop.
The Catholic bishop is definitely not integrated.
Yes.
But the priest isn't either. The priest isn't married. He's not really part of the community. He's part of the community in a way, but he's kind of an outsider. And so, you know, it's just a different dynamic. And the way the LDS lay clergy is set up is status, you know, really does matter, and is really emphasized in a way that's, I think, detrimental to the religious experience.
Well, one of the things that's happened in the LDS church, too, is in the absence of content creation. So because there hasn't been a prophet since Joseph Smith got killed, the church itself is more or less on autopilot, and it tends to absorb what its social and political allies are pushing out. So it has picked up all of this evangelical Christian stuff that is really alien to Mormonism, that has developed, actually largely developed after Mormonism developed, but it just is, since there's a vacuum, since Mormonism isn't producing anything new, so they just pick up on things like anti-abortion or anti-gay or anything that, you know, they're
any conservative social issue,
right? Yeah, that's popular among their peer group, you know. So
no, they line it up. They have a checklist there too. But the one thing that I would argue about that is that it's also been good. For example, it's been external pressure that has led to, you know, blacks getting the priesthood, and will, I would argue, within like 40 years, 30 years, you know, mean they'll find a way to accommodate gay rights. You know, in other words, the world tends to often be better than the church, and you want it to be open to that better.
Sure.
So should we I'm not sure that most of the listeners will be familiar with what axial religion. Does either one of you want to kind of flesh that out? Because, Jimmy, you like listed them, but I don't think people will be familiar. I'm not familiar with what the axial religions are.
when I'm talking about like where my views on religion are compared to anybody else's, I have a very broad perspective, which is a perspective that is not just from the past century in North America, but rather I'm thinking about it throughout all of history, and I'm also thinking about it around the world. And so a lot of our view of religion is intensely recent and ethnocentric and based on our own past. And I think that especially as ex-Mormons, we tend to think of religion through a very particular lens of knowing Mormonism really well and that not thinking about a lot of the rest of it. Anyway, and so in that way, I was going to, like I'd written in our little document ahead of time, you know, this idea about stages of religion or religious development that happened throughout history. And as Jim had mentioned, this is a really gross simplification. So, you know, and so this is not like, you know, this can't be, you know, universally maintained in any kind of details. And in fact, even the idea that there may have even been an axial age is called into question. That's something that was quite popular 40 years ago and may not be anymore as popular. But anyway, just to, as a thumbnail for this idea, the idea is that there is a, in the very first stage of historical development for civilization. So before there's this time, people don't actually understand what history is. So before there is history, history is things that are written. And so when we talk about prehistoric times, we go back in time, that happened in what we call history in terms of time travel or something like that, but it doesn't happen. It's not a historical time because there was nobody to write it down, right? So nobody had invented writing, and so they didn't write anything down. They may well have told, they had oral traditions, and they may have told each other stories that may well have been transmitted to people that eventually invented writing, and we may have them to some extent or other, to which we can argue. But anyway, history begins when people are starting to be able to write. And at the very earliest time period where we have writing, the kind of religion that people have is a, the two types of earliest religion are first like kind of an animism, where people are seeing spirits or energies as being involved in all of the different any force that they encounter, and they can't otherwise understand it, but they innately anthropomorphize it, and they try to relate to it and understand it and tell stories about it in order to live with it. And so they are seeing, let's say, the spirit of the river, and the river will come back, and any other kind of thing like that, right? The next stage that you have is where you anthropomorphize all of those forces, and so then the river is thought of as being a god who has you even think of it as having a human form somehow, but it's simultaneously a river, right? And same thing, that there the lightning that comes down and thunder, there's a god that is like a guy that's throwing that stuff, right? And simultaneously, anything else that you have as a abstract concept, even like death, there's a god, death. Death is a god, yeah. You know? And so then those are just, and so for us, we use the word god, and the word god, frankly, confounds and confuses us, because we are looking at it through our 3,000 years later prism of all the things that that word means to us. But if we think of it for the people at the time, what they think of it as meaning is death. So death is a kind of thing that's a god. Love, that kind of a force, the force of the flood, the force of the lightning, all of those kind of things. And so initially, all of those forces seem intensely chaotic to people. But over time, they start to realize that actually there are principles involved that can be very, very predicted. And so at first, their religion is all about sort of ritual appeasement, where they have to, if they do this kind of thing, then the sun will come back the next day. If they do this kind of thing, the flood will come back and refertilize the fields. If they do this
kind of
thing.
So really, it's kind of an attempt to create the illusion of control over a chaotic world.
I'd say that's half of it, and half of it is also transmitting important information to how to even stay alive. So in other words, what do we actually have to do in order to hunt and things like that?
Yeah, and it can have like spiritual dimensions too. I mean, you know, you've got, for example, like you go back to the Greeks, and you know, you've got the Oracle of Delphi or Delphi, you know, you ask questions, not just about your fate, but, you know, how you're living or how you ought to live and things like that. So there can be, and usually in all of these religions, there is a sense of, like, not only does it have to do with, like, fortune and misfortune, it could also be about conduct, right? But it does tend to be like an overall order that, first of all, there's nothing transcendent, right? There's nothing beyond the cosmos. The divine is actually within it, and there's all these sort of within the cosmos sort of forces like these gods, right? And second of all, you know, they're not necessarily benign. Now, to the extent they're benign, it has to do with things like fertility and ordinary human flourishing, you know, how things are going for you when it comes to, you know, your crops and whatever, hunting. But to the extent they're not divine, they can be indifferent, they can be hostile, they can be anything, right?
Right.
But there are certain benign elements to it. So I would say it's not just practical or transmitting information. It's also just questions, how do I live? I mean, like, you know,
sure.
If I peed against on that sacred tree, you know, maybe that's God getting pissed off because I did something wrong, you know.
Pissed off.
You know, oh, gosh, I did not. Yeah, pun not intended, but quite good.
Yeah.
I stand by it.
And so that's what I meant by saying, therefore, you're trying for appeasement, right? So in other words, if you don't piss on the tree, God won't be pissed at you. You know, so that's the, you know, so you are appeasing gods under those circumstances. And so that also then ties very strongly into the early status societies. And so all of the people who are rich are able to do all of the different rituals, and they're therefore in good with God, and God blesses them, and it's a regular system. But at a certain moment, what ends up happening is that people have there's a couple things that happen simultaneously. So one, people have start to have more sophisticated ideas of literature. They have they're not just doing basic record keeping. They actually are writing down stories, and they are realizing that over time their stories and ideas are changing. So they're actually, history starts to develop because they actually have things from the past that don't relate to their present very well. So that, on the one hand, is happening. Two, they also are having various breakthroughs where, for example, the Babylonians are doing fantastic astrology/astronomy. It's the same thing at the time, where they are very concerned with, like Jim was saying, divination. So they want to do divination through the movement of the stars. But what they also realize is that the movement of the stars is intensely predictable. And so suddenly, as opposed to these random happenstances like lightning, you didn't know when that was going to happen. You never know when, you know, this and these other crazy things were going to happen. You suddenly realize, wait a second, all of these heavenly occurrences happen in a very regular and orderly way. And so that gives all of these guys the impression that there may well be some underlying order behind all of the chaos. And so that starts to have people have theories that there is, you know, like a prime mover, like Aristotle's case or whatever, the unmoved mover. There may well be something that is causing, you know, the font of all order and that kind of thing in the universe. And then simultaneously, then there's also a new dimension where you're realizing, well, wait a second, so-and-so, Job, let's say, he is a rich man, he's done all these wonderful things, he was never sinned in any way, and yet, you know, all of his children got killed and this and that and all the other horrible things, he has boils on his skin. And so then they start to realize, well, wait a second, it may not be that these little ritual things that we do, just because I did every last sacrifice, I obeyed every last law, one of those things, maybe all of those things are actually in vain, and maybe instead there is something else that we should be doing, which is we have some, there's some kind of moral or ethical dimension that we're not, that our archaic laws, which may had some kind of archaic sense of morals in them, but now are increasingly, now that they've been written down, they're increasingly divorced from any of that kind of morality and ethics, which have also evolved, that maybe these religious reforms that we call from the Axial Age, maybe that will put us in touch with how to actually have right living, how to be a legitimate human being and therefore be back reconciled with the divine. You know, that we're now sensing is maybe something bigger than these little chaotic forces. So maybe God, if there is a God in that way, is actually wanting us to be nice to poor people, as opposed to simply, you know, doing some ostentatious ritual that we used to think was so good. So in sum, then, that idea is that all of those Axial Age reformers, and Jim listed them all off, which are everything from Buddhism to Taoism to the Greek philosophers to later Judaism, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, etc.
Oh, that's the one you miss, Zoroastrianism.
Sorry.
That's the first one.
I'm actually, it's 2-0 now.
I mean, where did you want to go from the Axial religions? Trying to figure out how to fuse your two pedantic outlines here. So do you have it, Jimmy? I mean, what do you have any response to what John's kind of take on?
Well, I mean, one thing is I would say that maybe there was something a little, and I think John would actually agree with this, that there was something a little more interesting in the pagan world than that way of doing it would be, like at least in certain pockets of it. But the basic thing is that these ways of questioning that came out of these religions, one thing that was really interesting to me is that they were really, for the first time, coming up with really complicated and sophisticated ways of dealing with these existential questions and that we were talking about. So, for example, let's go with Buddha and Buddhism, right? He, was coming up with this response to the fact that we age, we get sick, we die, that things are unsatisfactory, that suffering is a fundamental feature of existence, and he's trying to figure out a way to respond to that that is unusual. Where he talks of, sorry about that.
Fucking Zach. It's really like, it's just like in Young Dr. Frankenstein, Frau Blücher.
I could hear him walking around with his goddamn paws.
It's fundamentally unsatisfying.
Bark, bark.
Yeah, do you want me to? I'm going to put him out back. That might stress him out. I'll put him in the bedroom. I'll close the door. Just a second.
Hey, listeners, this is John Hamer. I'm breaking in because right after Jimmy had to let his dog out, we picked back up the conversation, but not where we'd left off. Instead, we started talking about Randy's personal religion of watching Notre Dame football, and so I'm going to reinsert us back with that little splice.
Unfortunately, it's the weekend of one of the holy days.
Okay. What's your high holidays?
USC plays Notre Dame at Notre Dame, so right. I get to go to the Notre Dame campus and look at all the fake memorials that they have for all the aborted children in the world.
Right.
They awesome. Have that there?
They have. They're hidden in the shrubbery, but they're headstones that are that literally say on them, in memory of all the aborted children of the world.
Oh, dear. Wow. That's where you get to then engage in your rituals of sympathetic magic where you're saying, no, don't do it. And that makes the football go the other way because,
right,
because
right.
You're saying that.
There's nothing more superstitious than a sports fan.
Well, no, it's actually someone who plays sports.
Yeah, but someone who plays sports actually has an effect on the game.
Yeah.
And the people watching it have zero, if they're watching on TV, they have zero effect.
But they still do that.
Oh, yeah. My God. I did it all the time. Like, I would say, if USC wasn't doing well while I was watching, I would leave for 10 minutes just because I thought that my watching was having a negative effect on it.
Oh, no.
I mean, it was such primitive superstition.
Yeah.
Your presence traveled.
Right?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you're astrally projecting your bad vibes.
Yes. But, I also believed that a dude looked through magic stones and translated. So, I mean, it wasn't that much different.
But that thing that you were believing, though, I think is incredibly common even on people who, let's say, are not otherwise members of fundamentalist religions.
Yeah, there's something inherent about, and again, I still think it goes back to this, wanting to gain control over the uncontrollable.
Sure.
Trying to give order to chaos. Just the sense of not having any control is very, it creates so much cognitive dissonance in the human brain. And I think I mean, that's certainly one aspect of superstition and primitive religion.
Well, I think it just comes naturally. I do it without believing it's doing anything, but I start twisting and turning. It's like sympathetic bodily response, you know. And, right. You know, it's just something that we do, just like when we're bowling and we're not superstitious, but we, you know, we get the bowling ball, you know, we affect it with our, you know.
You're like, and you're like doing a little dance, and it's like, if you only like stay on the 1 foot and then, no! Yeah. All your weight goes to the, if your weight goes on that side, then it's going to go, no, just a little bit more. Yeah, exactly. Sympathetic magic, yeah.
Well, and there's also the knocking on wood, I think, is, you know, like you say something, well, I hope this really bad thing doesn't happen, and then you knock on wood, or you say knock on wood. Like, you know, you not doing that will allow it to happen. I think there's tons of secular...
Another one is Amy Schumer. On Amy Schumer's show, she has Bill Nye on there, and he's like doing like a cosmos like thing where he's explaining how the universe is causing cosmic effects.
The universe. For centuries, humankind has strived to understand this vast expanse of energy, gas, and dust. In recent years, a stunning breakthrough has been made in our concept of what the universe is for.
So I was texting while I was driving, and I ended up taking a wrong turn that took me directly past a vitamin shop. And I was just like, this is totally the universe telling me I should be taking calcium.
Oh my God.
Right?
Universe.
Scientists once believed the universe was a chaotic collection of matter. We now know the universe is essentially a force, sending cosmic guidance to white women in their 20s.
It used to be just like chaos and necessity.
Right.
Now.
Or people would have attributed it to God was telling them that, or whatever it is. In other words, the people, all of those people who have become nominally secular, they don't have any forum for discussing these ideas theologically or philosophically in their lives, have nevertheless continued to have a what we might say is a fairly religiously primitive view of things, where they're saying the universe is telling them something because they experience this coincidence.
You know, we don't quite have that sort of world of like that complicated, like signs and symbols sort of cosmos, right? And we don't have a common way of speaking about that stuff, but we have a lot of privatized sort of supernaturalisms, you know, and, you know, a lot of it is like in that New Age tradition where it's like incredibly self-absorbed. And so you've got, you know, you've got the cosmos, and you know, you start trying to manifest, and you try to like take care of like your destiny by controlling quantum physics and Deepak Chopra and shit. And it's like really, really gross. But
yeah,
it's the secret.
Yeah, the secret is like, and that's, you know, kind of debased transcendentalism, you know, with like an astral and cosmic sort of spin and a lot of kitsch.
And as a regular thing now, as a stand in for, you know, well, you're in our thoughts and prayers, which would have been a regular cultural way of saying, you know, expressing support before. Now the people are saying, I'm sending positive energy your way. Or something like that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you know, and chakras have been scientifically proven in my kind of like quasi-spiritual pseudoscientific hole that I've got. And but, you know, I think that that's actually a feature of a democratic society, right, where you have freedom of conscience and, you know, the possibility of all these privatized sort of supernaturalisms that no one's going to bug you over. You know, and you get to choose yourself. It's a matter of your own, you know. I mean, people aren't that really good at that sort of thing, making up their own religion, you know.
No. I agree, they're not.
It's like, you know, it's like, I think, John, you've said that before. It's like, I can't make up my own religion, you know. I think Randy quoted you saying.
No, he was like, because in a conversation where it was supposed to be about the historical Jesus, and Bob, 5 minutes in, decided he didn't really give a shit about the historical Jesus. It then turned into, you know, Bob questioning John, like, okay, you have these specific beliefs. why don't you then start your own religion? And John's answer was, you know how hard it is to start a religion? It's so much easier to take an established vehicle and then take the keys.
Yeah, you got infrastructure. You've got you've got a whole history that you can build on.
And, well, it is actually
an adult.
It's intensely hard to start something, though. I mean, as anybody who tries to put together, you know, some kind of atheist organizations, they have a bunch of them that they're trying to start, you know, secular, secular communities where they're really,
The Church of Satan with,
I've got to tell you guys, a perfect example is the Secular Humanist Mormon Association. They have this sort of like read on sacrament that is preciously bad. Yeah, it's like they do a sacrament to capital R reason, and they do all of these sort of things, and they have these sort of like statements of principles and ethics and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, really, you know, I'm sure it's just five people and maybe even one person, but it's certainly like a sign that, you know, amateurism, you know, reigns in that particular thing, because they are building it kind of, they're bootstrapping. Right.
But it's also really hard then for anybody to take that seriously, too.
Well, and if you do like actually insert yourself into a tradition that actually has 2000 years and maybe an Augustine or an Aquinas that's part of it, or, you know, like the great, you know, Buddhist like Nagarjuna and all, you know, or whatever. Right. The great Zens, Dogen and all that sort of stuff. You know, right. If you want to secularize it, you've got something that has been addressing in really, really interesting ways these existential problems, right? And so you've got like a really wonderful movement in the West of secularized Buddhism. And there's a website, secularbuddhism.org, and there's some really high caliber people. But they're, you know, they're piggybacking on a great tradition. And it's very, very interesting. And they're just kind of like getting rid of, you know, rebirth and, you know, the crude notions of karma and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But there's still all of the Buddhist psychology. There's this sense of like your place in an impermanent world, et cetera, that they get to use and to inhabit.
Yeah. And so I think that that's a perfectly wonderful thing to be doing. But from my own perspective on that is that when you're doing that, you're repurposing something that is more or less wholly alien. And so you have to have studied some very esoteric stuff that you'll never particularly understand it, because you're coming from outside the tradition. And so you're really repurposing it.
I would argue that they're repurposing in a way that could revitalize it, at least in the Buddhist case. So, you know, you've got people. There's a guy named Stephen Batchelor, Batchelor, who, you know, was a Tibetan monk, lived in basically India as a monk for 13 years, and then was, you know, Korean Zen, married a Zen nun and all that, who's intimately aware from the inside of it, but he left it because of certain things that we would consider like, you know, features of religious orthodoxy that, you know, just weren't compelling to him. But what happened
basically were like supernatural things.
Yeah, supernatural things, and also just kind of rigidity. And so he's doing really interesting work, actually, that is and would be really good for people who come from the traditional thing. You know, and like the Dalai Lama, who's in the Tibetan tradition, has been strongly influenced by people like him and, you know, his encounter with the West. And so I think that there's something that's organically developing that's kind of interesting. I wouldn't consider myself a Buddhist, but I've learned a lot from it. And, you know, I think that you can responsibly repurpose certain things like that. I don't think that you need to just go out of your Christian tradition. In fact, the Christian elements of your background, of your heritage, can actually be good for certain elements of the Buddhism or your understanding of political equality. You know, Buddhism doesn't have a political philosophy. Let's make it so that democracy and Buddhism come together, you know. And so,
well, in that way, though, I'm not saying that it wouldn't be wonderful to repurpose the traditions which are existing. When I'm saying it's alien, I mean from a North American standpoint. So yes, if you are able to go at a certain point in your life and, you know, live a life in Asia, learn all of the languages, be a monk for 13 years, all those kind of things, then you may well be able to, you know, be that person who's doing that translating, who can then affect that tradition internally and also bring something back over here that would be that people who aren't doing that could handle. But what I'm suggesting is that from the perspective of somebody who is in this tradition, who isn't able to do all of those kind of things, that those elements, like you're talking about, like since the Christian tradition is also intensely rich in all kinds of different types of thought, that you can pull strands out of it and bring those together in a way that would also be completely that it can also be completely wonderful without maintaining the baggage. So,
in the same way you do with Buddhism. Are you saying that you've chose the Christian tradition because it's simply more prudent, more practical?
For you.
Okay.
I'm not saying that there's any, by far and away, I'm not saying that Christianity is a true religion and Buddhism is false. I don't believe that for a second. So in other words, all the traditions, you're able to build on any tradition, even ones that are fairly simplistic, you would be able to repurpose them.
Yeah, and I would argue, though, that like Buddhism, as one example, addresses certain features of human existence that Christianity is not so good on. The problems of like the fact that we live in an impermanent world, that we have this tendency to grasp at things and try to make them solid when they're going to slip away. The fact that life is unsatisfactory in so many ways, the sort of psychology that's involved there, and the fact that once repurposed, you can bring it into an easier connection with science. I find like when I go to the Christianity side of things, and I love, I read the Bible all the time, blah, 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 and there's, Jesus has really influenced me. There are certain areas where it's just kind of like not very rich. And so I think it's been to the benefit of Western society to import some of that stuff.
I don't disagree. I think that in other words, Buddhism's wonderful, but on the other hand, I think that in some ways, Westerners naively approach Buddhism and they imagine all kinds of wonderful Eastern things, and they clip away like vast amounts of the garbage that they would really hate, the fundamentalist portions of it that are very severe and would have been intensely severe in the Dalai Lama's, let's say, early childhood. He's now transcended his existence and done all kinds of incredible stuff, but what the society that he would have grown up in, let's say, and what regular Tibetans are operating like, is nothing that you probably are going to be really excited about. And so anyway, my point is that there's a lot
that you
of
give to Buddhism is modernity, right?
Sure.
The Enlightenment, science, individual rights, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, non-hierarchical way of looking at society, so on and so forth. And yeah, that's actually a feature, not a bug. Like, yeah, let's get rid of that stuff because who wants that? It's not good. And so that's one of the reasons that a lot of people resist. A lot of people say, well, that's not authentic Buddhism. And some of the secular people say in return, well, it's not like, there is a true Buddhism that we're violating. It's like this is possibilities within Buddhism that might be good for everyone, But I think that you and I actually agree pretty much, pretty fundamentally. I worry that we're going to agree on everything.
Well, I think that for all of those things, so like when we're talking about like for axial age religions like Buddhism or Christianity, once the religious thinker, the Buddha, obviously the Buddha was a historical figure way back when. We can't get at him very much because we don't even know within like a long period of time when he would have even lived. And so getting through the traditions to the actual historical figure is very complicated, but let's say we'll get back to whatever the historical figure would have been. That's a person that, despite later traditions, isn't actually perfect, because he's a real person. And so what happened was, though, that the claim of the religion, when the religion becomes a universal religion, because it's claiming this is how the universe works, it's not just a provincial, tribal religion that's understanding what their local the pre-axial age religion, the pre-universal religion, when you have these, when you have your Iron Age kingdom, where Jehovah Yahweh is your God of Israel, and he will smite the God of the Amorites for you if you, don't worship, Moloch. because you keep on wanting to worship Moloch. Moloch has all these, temple prostitutes, and you're like, Moloch, I love Moloch with the temple prostitutes, but no, okay, Yahweh, yeah, okay. So because he'll smite the Amorites for us. Okay, I remember. I hate the Amorites. Okay, you know, that kind of thing. So once you get past that kind of religion and you get to a universal religion, all of these guys, Buddha, Jesus, are guys, and no matter how great, you know, they, like, later in myth you make Jesus into a god and you make him incredible, and Buddha is transcendent and he becomes a god in some versions of Buddhism. So the difference between the particulars, which is to say all of the particulars that are Jesus's own time and place in history, the Buddha's own time and place in history, where he's limited by what he knows, the ideas that exist at the time, all of the bigotries and biases and lack of innovation, lack of ideas that we have that they don't have, they don't know those things. And so they're limited in their particulars. On the other hand, they also are claiming a universal, which is the universal ideal. And that's the thing that they long for. So on the one hand, when we look at these universal religions, we tend to look at the particulars and say, oh, this particular is totally wrong, and that one's totally wrong, and that one's totally wrong, and that means the religion is false. But in fact, we can just discard all of those things, because it's equally true for those people was the aspiration, which was the universal, and say the universal is what really mattered and not all those particulars. And so we don't need those dogmatic particulars, and we shouldn't focus on them. We should get rid of them.
So what is left? Because if they're not, you're not going to be rooted. You have an aspiration to the universal, and yet you're rooted in the particulars and you want to keep the universal aspiration. What is that independent of the particulars? You know, the false universalization leaves behind an aspiration that you're saying is kind of like an essential spiritually, right?
Right.
Okay, and so what is the content of that aspiration, and how does it, you know, come back down to earth in particulars, like, you know, how we live here now in the 21st century in the United States, or in, you know, in Ecuador or in Australia or in Southeast Asia, you know?
Well, I would say that functionally,
I'm just trying to say it.
Yeah. No, I would say that functionally that works similarly to the way science works, which is to say that you don't have, just because people theorize this and that, you know, at one point or other, that, and then they were wrong. There is no phylogen or actually atomic theory, you know, from Democritus. Democritus is wrong, because there actually are particles that you can split from the atom. Atom isn't the smallest material you can get to. Get smaller than that. That doesn't mean there's no atoms. You know, in other words, we don't have to take that away and throw everything out. But rather, what we have is a system of moving towards that aspiration, of moving towards more and more knowledge and more understanding. And that's where you have it. So, I mean, as opposed to being fixated on any of the particulars.
So are you saying it's like a process of building knowledge, building on knowledge?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm still kind of unclear on that, because I understand that there's a process of building on knowledge, and so, like, one of the things we got globally going on is actually science, right, and modernity, and, you know, perhaps, like, even the rise of, you know, wider spread, you know, rights and so on and so forth. But so let's just do a test case. Like, what about, like, how do we incorporate that into Christianity, right? How does Christianity relate to that in a given community, such as the community of Christ, or in relationship to, you know, being a Baptist or something like that?
Well, so I'm not going to speak for Baptists. Baptists, I feel like, don't have a good idea about what they're doing often.
Well,
I mean, I don't know.
But there's the whole... There's the more traditional Baptist thing where, you know, you got your soul liberty and there's a certain sort of, like, personal relationship between you and the Bible. It's not, as, like, one person who was part of that tradition said, it's not like the new Catholic Church of the South, right, where it's just, like, dominating everything. But there was, like, much more, you know, kind of an interesting, almost quasi-Quakerish sort of way of doing things for them.
So for them, so Baptists, like a lot of Protestants, are scripture worshipers. And so they think of the Bible as being itself divine, or, you know, inerrant and all these other kinds of things. And so that is based on a misunderstanding of how the Bible was created, and so you can, which can be traced through history. So it's a falsifiable claim, and so it doesn't. I mean, it's a problematic thing to base your entire religion on. So if you have an idea that that's where everything is, the sole source of authority is by reading the Bible in some sort of inerrant or literalistic sense or anything like that, that's not going to get you anywhere.
Well, like, what would be the case, though? I mean, like, if you talk about the history of Christianity, they didn't simply read the Bible literalistically, right?
Right.
In that sense, but they did take it. They did take the historical facts to be true. In fact, you know, the kind of like, for example, Augustine and then Aquinas did this too. You know, you've got the historical sense, which you have to recognize is true. It did happen. That's why Augustine like did all kinds of arguments about like defending Noah's Ark against pagan critics who said it was impossible to get all those animals in, right, you know, in the boat. And in fact, like Origen got in a lot of trouble, and one of the reasons he was kind of like excluded from sainthood was that he just got a little crazy in his allegorizing, right? He went a little bit too far. So, like, in a certain sense, like, if you're going to, you know, well, criticize...
So I don't think Origen went too far.
Yeah, no, I think...
I think Origen was
historical
doing...
Historical Christianity.
Just fine, yeah. So, I mean...
Yeah, Origen was doing great.
He was on a great path. That's great. So, and I think that Augustine understood the... Augustine understood that where the money was. In other words, if there was a place where you couldn't defend it, he was prepared to say that's clearly not, shouldn't be read literally there. And so, and he would say that if you read it literally there, that's blasphemy. Whereas, like you say, he's like semi-conservative on that, which is to say he's like drawing the line back to anything that he feels like he can defend, right?
Post-Origin, though, like the prime rule was make sure, within the Christian tradition, was make sure that the first rule is that you don't diminish the basic fundamental historical parts of the Bible, right? And so, you know, that was like a real problem for people. Now, Origen was like a possibility that I guess you could actually, I mean, I love Origen. He also thought that possibly or probably hell would be empty, right?
Right.
But, you know, I just wonder, like, is there... So I guess what you're saying is that because of progress and what we know, that's an option for us is to
Augustine
progress.
Is operating before the invention of academic history. So in other words, Augustine didn't have the academic history as part of his repertoire. He wasn't able to determine what happened or didn't happen based on archaeology, source criticism, all of the kind of things that we're able to discern. And given the fact that he's a genius, he would have probably, you know, who knows what he would, anyway, the point of it is that we're, you know, it's like any number of geniuses from the past, you know, they're limited by their own time and place in history, as they're all writers in any time period, including scripture writers. And so Augustine is similarly limited, but anyway, so that we now are living in a period of time when we have access to those historical things, and those things didn't happen. So Noah's Ark is a myth, Tower of Babel's a myth, you know, all the United Kingdom of David and Solomon are a myth, you know, there's all kinds of myths. So
how would you relate to the Bible, like, in terms of, like, you know, the question of its authority and the question of its relationship to wisdom and my, you know, my worship, given the fact that that is a crucial document? And, you know, if you're going to be Christian, you got to have some place for the Bible.
Right. So it's the core document of Western civilization, you know. So in other words, we've talked about it more throughout the past 2,000 years than any other book. I mean, there's other things that, you know, important, Shakespeare and some of the other things in the English-speaking world. And so what else do you do with it? So in terms of being authoritative, the Community of Christ statement on Scripture is that the Bible is authoritative in the model of Jesus, where Jesus did not come at the way that was the expected Messiah or king, which is to say as an authoritarian ruler who would be like a dictator ruling over the earth, but it was instead a servant to everyone. And so in the same exact way, the Bible's authority being modeled on Jesus is as a servant. And so it is not inerrant. It is not scientifically or historically inerrant. It is not a rule book. It isn't any of those kind of things, but rather it is useful in a serving purpose, which is turning us towards the idea of how are we living a good life, thinking about how we're able to be good humans, how are we able to be reconciled with the universe, the divine.
So to you, it's very similar in its usefulness as, like, say, Othello from Shakespeare. Like, there's certain things you can learn about the human condition in Othello, especially about evil.
Sure. And Othello is also similarly useful. It would be nice if I had a group of people who wanted to read let's say the Canterbury Tales, since I'm a medievalist as opposed to an early modernist. So if I had a person who was, you know, a group of people who wanted to get together and read that with me, you know, which I know a lot about the background to that or something, then I would be able to, you know, we would be able to have discussions about the human condition with people who are fundamentally increasingly alien to us. So even though Shakespeare and Chaucer and, you know, our English-speaking or Middle English or later English-speaking peoples who are related to us in some way, they are coming from a time period that is alien enough to us that by just even seeing that time period, we are able to see all of the societal strictures around us as for how more arbitrary or artificial or traditional or, you know, all those kind of things than we otherwise could see without having that additional perspective. And so actually spending, you know, a weekly hour in Bible study where we're doing Old Testament this year with a whole group of people in my congregation, you know, we are really seeing very alien people, you know, since it's we've been reading the book of Judges and Joshua lately, and you know, so pre-axial age people with intensely different values, just insanely alien values. And so then we kind of are seeing, okay, let's just step back and think about the human condition, given the fact that we're getting this additional perspective all the time. So
in a way, the choice of using the Bible and, say, this lectionary form of doing the Bible, you know, there's nothing in principle that, you know, disallows you putting anything into it, whether it's Shakespeare, whether it's a great poem by Anthony Hecht, or whether it's, you know, Plato or anything like that. But you've got an anchor there in the Bible, right? That is something that's a common world that you guys can share. And since you don't think the Bible's inerrant, it frees you up just to use it as a starting point and a potential source of wisdom, at least a source of reflection on what we're doing. Is that an accurate way of stating what you're doing?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely, because we actually condemn it too. You know, so in other words, if there's a value that are expressed, yeah, we're saying this is horrible. Yeah.
Well, and like you said, you know, it's just a very, very pre-axial sort of way of looking at what God wants.
Right. Well, all of the people around the Israelites are not people.
Yeah. No, there are Amalekites and other variants of that.
Midianites.
Yeah. But you could conceivably, you know, take up, like, the figure of Socrates, for example.
Absolutely.
And integrate it. Or you could, like, for instance, one of my favorite things, I just finished teaching it last year, that I hadn't read since I was like 25, and reading it now in my late 40s, it's just astonishingly good. And that's The Winter's Tale by Shakespeare, where it is about the question of how do you respond to the fact of irretrievably bad misconduct, something that you can't redeem. Right, and what sort of way do you deal with that, and how do you deal with, and how do the people that you've harmed irreparably respond to that? And, you know, that would be a wonderful thing to do in connection with the whole notion of repentance, right?
Right.
And, you know, restoration, when in this case it's limited, you can't take back. You know, so I could see really a lot of great things once you open up to the broader culture, but you've got an anchor in the Bible.
So what I'm hearing is Jimmy is volunteering to be a guest lecturer, or a guest, doing a guest sermon at your congregation.
Yeah, sounds good. No, I mean, I'm absolutely open to Socrates and Shakespeare, and I mean, I'm excited to actually do. Since in the Restoration we tend to totally forget all of Christianity from the New Testament until Joseph Smith, and then actually only focus on Joseph Smith only, you know, is the basic tradition. Well, so actually there's incredible amounts of thought to read Origen, to read Augustine, to read Boethius, I'm amazed by how compelling Boethius is after, you know, all this time, you know. I mean, anyway, so it's just amazing, you know, and there's a lot to think about, you know, just from those.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know Boethius, he was a Christian philosopher about a century after Augustine, who was in an awful situation where he had been arrested and he was basically on his way to being executed unjustly. And the question he's asking is, okay, how is it? It's basically a Job sort of question, like how is this possible? And and the thing that's really interesting about it is that he doesn't mention, although there are certain like slight things where you know that he's read as Augustine and all that, he does it in a way that's entirely secular. And so, you know, that sort of thing is he's really just wonderful. So I recommend his book, Consolations of Philosophy.
So I got a question for you, Jimmy. Don't feel a need, or you never really felt a need for community. And John, really, isn't that, I mean, that's one of the major thrusts of your, or at least one of your biggest motivations is that you feel like a sense of community is an important thing. Is that true?
Well, so I think that one of the problems with, I think philosophy is absolutely wonderful, but I think that one of the problems has been that philosophers are not, with a few exceptions. So in late antiquity, the time period when Christianity was on its rise, that was a moment of there was actual real popular philosophy, and maybe 5 or 10% of people in the Roman Empire were actively engaged in deciding that they'd become a Stoic or something like that, or an Epicurean, or whatever they all were. They were all deciding about it. But generally speaking, it's limited to a very tiny proportion of the population. And so the average ex-Mormon who leaves their fundamentalist faith doesn't actually tend to embark on a serious philosophical exploration where they come up with a new, let's say, epistemological framework through which to view the universe around them. Instead, they just, you know, buy into a couple ex-Mormon narratives, and that settles the world for them satisfactorily, and they're off doing that. So for me, the point here is, in philosophy, I don't think is in any way hostile to the way I envision religion. I think it's a component of the way I envision religion, and I think that the point of religion, therefore, is how do we connect to a broader portion of the society. So how are we able to inject these ideas and to give people a forum, a community, a network, a place where they have a tradition of engaging on these ideas, you know? And so...
So it's more about general access. When you think back to the ancient times, like you said, 5% of the elite and intelligentsia even had access to it. So what you're trying to do is broaden the access to a broader community to facilitate them embarking on these deeper ways of thinking about the world.
Right. Give them a forum and a network, a place to do it, a reason for it. And again, it's not reinventing the wheel, but we can also jettison all of the parts of the wheel that are filled with crap, you know.
Yeah, no, for me that makes total sense. And in terms of my own personal situation, I wouldn't say that I feel no need for community, but I didn't
mean to say that you didn't have a need for community. It's that you already had a community.
Well, in certain ways, what happens for me is that I've got kind of like a community that just only someone who is an obsessive reader of philosophy, literature, science, so on and so forth, right? Could, you know, I've got the great work of all of those historians that managed to specialize, right, on something. All of the scientists that have done cognitive psychology and social psychology, all of the theologians. I've got just, you know, I've got Plato, Aristotle, I've got blah, 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 blah. In other words, I've got kind of a notional community already. But in terms of coming up with ideas about how to live personally, right, you know, and, you know, I've got kind of a kitchen sink way of doing it. Where, you know, take from Buddhism, take from Stoicism, whatever, and fashion it all together. This is my sense of aesthetics. That is something that works for someone like me who is, like, you know, goes into like almost a trance when I'm reading about this stuff, and I think about it and I integrate it into my life, right? And I don't think that that would work for most people. And, you know, there are always real dangers of going off into a private, you know, weird sphere of just like your own, you know, private invention of a way of looking at things that's just preposterous or ridiculous or spiritually isolating or makes you an asshole. And, you know, I mean, that is like a risk I'm taking, but I, you know, I don't necessarily find much better when I go into a community, but that's for me personally. Furthermore, I do get community, and that's as a teacher. And so, like, I am engaging all the time with the needs of kids, right? Of people that are suffering from anxiety and don't want to be in a classroom, people that are really curious and want me to give them a link to the, you know, that would like assuage their curiosity there, you know, people that are like dealing with bullying or, you know, there's a whole sort of reality that they are that definitely means that I've got to be up to the task of living well in a community. If I didn't teach, I would be seeking out a community of fellow people that are concretely trying to deal with their issues.
Yeah, good luck finding it.
Well,
there's all kinds of good communities.
Yeah, no, there are, and I just don't need them. And I've been frustrated when I remember going to a Unitarian church and I was in the adult education thing and the discussion was just egregious. You know, there was a guy who was like a Unitarian atheist, but I'm a Unitarian guy who they were taking up the problem of evil, and the whole discussion got off on whether the tsunami, you know, in where was that tsunami in 2004?
Sumatra. Was that Indonesia?
Yeah, it was Indonesia. In Indonesia. Yeah. And so the guy was saying, yeah, well, what I believe is that, you know, these natural forces had an intent and it was for everyone's good. And then everyone just went off on that. And I was like, oh, God, I got to get out of here. And I've had several experiences like that, you know, where you go to a Buddhist community and suddenly everyone's reading Ken Wilber, who's like a New Age guy who is preposterously bad.
Not Ken Wilber.
You know? And so I, you know, I do get frustrated and I feel like I am served better reading people that, you know, that are going to discipline me, you know, read Augustine, read Plato, read Aristotle, read, you know, a great modern philosopher, read, you know, Kwame Anthony Appiah, who's a great philosopher, you know, read Charles Taylor, whatever, like, you know, go read Shakespeare poetry and all that. And it turns out to be a better kind of community for me. Given the fact that I already have a community where I have to worry about the lives of very specific people, you know, my daughter's like that too, and so is my wife, but I don't know how generalizable that is.
Yeah, then that's if I'm looking for a community and the binding force is spirituality, philosophy, how to live the good life, I'm worried about just getting disillusioned really quickly by what they're saying. And so, you know, and I've tried secular communities. I've tried ex-Mormon communities, and a lot of times ex-Mormon communities just are, mostly people that are in the anger phase and they want to just talk about what a horrible person, Brigham Young was, or what a, philanderer Joseph Smith was. And it's like, yeah, I get that. I'm past that.
Yeah.
I don't want to be angry all the time. And so, I don't know where to look. And then I go to like skeptic communities and there's such a dearth of culture amongst them. And they're usually end up being like, sci-fi nerds. And I just want to walk away. I got to go stand over there for now and walk away. And
well, there's nothing wrong with being a sci-fi nerd, but seriously, I think that it's a wonderful thing for certain people to be.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being a sci-fi nerd. It's just not what I want to be around. It's not what I want to talk about.
Well, like in those communities, there's always the possibility of just like looking for conviviality and human connection, right? But what John's talking about, if I've got it right, is actually taking up the question of the good life in the context of community, so you have the problem of living together through all of the life events and difficulties that people go through, and you have a way of talking about it that's rooted in a powerful tradition that you don't have to take as sacrosanct but is rich and a starting point. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. You should record a commercial for me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think it's recorded here, right, already. But I think that that's really wonderful. I honestly would be looking for that sort of a community if I didn't already have it built in, you know, into my professional life, you know, if I worked for Google or something like that, or
right.
Target, you know.
Target? You went yeah. from Google to Target?
Yeah.
So,
right.
Yeah,
so, yeah, my work life. So, I mean, since my main job is that I'm creative director for an insurance magazine, you know, so I obviously, you know, I'm not getting, you know, any kind of like meaning out of that, right? So it is a very, you know, it's still creative work. I enjoy blah, blah, blah. I'm very good at it, but that's not where I'm fine. I'm not. You may not have even heard that before, that that's my job, right? You know, because that's not my identity, right? In other words, that's not where I'm, that's not what I'm living my life for.
So, John, I actually got a question for you. Obviously your congregation, you would wholeheartedly, endorse, but, what do you have to say about all the, Community of Christ congregations across the North American, you know, across the United States and Canada? Are you going to get anything similar to what you're getting? Because when I lived for 4 years in Jackson County, Missouri. I mean, you couldn't swing a dead cat from a rope without hitting
right.
a Community of Christ congregation. There, I mean,
you could,
our last house, there was one that was walking distance from my house.
Yeah, you could have had every variety of Community of Christ congregation in the universe there. That's it. I mean, in other words, you've got everything you want. I mean, they're all different, and you can nuance it down to whatever you really like by going to any one of the 50 ones that are all totally different from each other. So you would be able to find it there. It's not true everywhere, but on the other hand, you know, like to, for Jim's example from, going to the Unitarian church, and there was a really horrible teacher, you know, and you're going to go to a Community of Christ congregation if anybody were to go to one, and you may well have somebody who even gives you a hellfire and brimstone thing might even happen. You know, some old poor old evangelist may well give you that kind of a sermon, right? But, yeah. But
well, in this case, it wasn't a horrible teacher, although the teacher was kind of, you know, sloppy and vague and kind of like confused.
Yeah.
It was the whole congregation.
Okay.
It's like they all jumped on the everything happens for a reason thing with this sort of like naturalistic sort of there's no transcendent God behind it, but you know, there's okay. this tsunami that knows what it's doing, and everyone's like, yeah, and suffering, you know, and it was like,
man.
And it was like, and this
tsunami?
Was,
wow.
Yeah, this was like, oh, they were all educated too.
Wow.
And so this is what I would think that probably, let's see if I'm diagnosing you right, John. It really helps to be the one in charge, guiding the doing quality control.
No,
so
no, no.
You
what
could be tremendous. No, I'm saying
sure, it would help.
Like,
that. Yeah, it would help. But yes.
Yeah.
But it's not just you don't have to be in charge. It is a matter of, in the same exact way, if there was gonna, if I wanted to say, let's say, make all of the podcast always be about singing, then the fact that I make singing podcasts is what makes that happen, right? So it's not just about me. You know, it's not only about like if wishes are horses kind of thing. If you go and you do the thing, it'll be that way. So in other words, my point is that the Community of Christ congregations are all intensely malleable. So your comment there about that the whole congregation has these twisted ideas, I wouldn't think that's likely. I mean, any one of the congregations could be, you know, all twisted in some
way. Well, perhaps
way.
The people who who knows,
raised their
like,
hand and spoke.
Yeah.
He probably took it in a direction that other people were enthusiastic about. And there's a lot of vague new agey sort of stuff going on that, you know, is conducive to that. And I'm sure other people were rolling their eyes or just walking out, tiptoeing out, hoping not, you know.
So John, are you saying be the change that you want?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that the congregations have their individual character, and every single individual member is different. And so, and since there is again that whole lay aspect of it, at any given time, you may well be getting a sermon from, you know, somebody who, you know, has, you know, very out of step views with even that congregation. So,
do you think that sometimes that can even be a feature, not a bug? It's like, we're here together, and this guy's really trying, and let's support him, and you know, let's make something out of this, and all that. And that actually I could see as like a really good aspect of having a community, right? Is supporting people in that situation is everybody tries together to figure things out and takes their turn.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's like, contrast that to the Mormon situation where there is already a script. Anyone who deviates from the script, all of a sudden there's a chill in the room, you know, and they're immediately either marginalized or vilified. Right. And so the Mormon church, like the things that they do that are so great is the community thing. You know, anywhere you go, you can plug right into automatic community. Your kids are going to go camping. You know, they're going to be involved in scouts, but then it comes with at such a price, you know, where that your kids are going to be indoctrinated in really bad thinking and bigoted shit too. And,
just by the way, I'll just point out, we have kids camps everywhere across North America. And by the way, our whole kids program is like young peacemakers where people are just taught to like promote peace and be environmentalists or whatever. So there you go.
So it is Boy Scouts.
Ugh. Not Boy Scouts. No, there's no thing with
no atheists, no gays allowed.
Yeah, we would
But also just it's Boy Scouts. I hated Boy Scouts. That was like one of the worst parts of growing up as a Mormon. It was breaking Dad's heart because I couldn't bear it anymore when I was 14.
I totally got out of it I finished being Eagle. I got my Eagle Scout 1 month after I turned 13, and that's it. I'm done.
Get it over with early.
Yeah, it was over.
At 13, I was still a tenderfoot. Actually, I wasn't even going to Scouts. Scouts was a horrible, horrible experience for me. And I was actually vocally, even as a believer, I was very critical of Scouts. I would never bear my testimony about the scouting program. And then those fuckers called me to be Scoutmaster. And suddenly I was obligated to bear my testimony on the divinity of the church using scouting as its young men's program. God, 2 years.
And I want to say that some kids really flourish in scouting, and I don't want to like draw, but I just thought it wasn't a very great experience. And it's compulsory scouting is just a terrible thing to do to kids.
And the ironic thing is the Mormon church controls about 1/4 of the revenue of the entire scouting program. So if they pull out because of this, you know, this change in policy about gay leaders, scouting program is going to suffer financially.
Except for it could possibly regrow again now, finally, after this whole period of
cut out the tumor.
Yeah, exactly. So in other words, this weight that has been taking it to the depth in watery death, and now it's cut out, and who knows, it can surface back up again and actually be a thing.
A thing. So, Randy, where is the what was this vision that you had that we're supposed to be?
We were going to duke it out.
No, really, it wasn't to duke it out because I thought that would have been an interesting and in poor taste. But I wanted John to deliver his message on community and his faith and how it can enrich lives and blah blah blah, and then I wanted you to give Jimmy the secular way of living the good life and how you've but really it's you're kind of a savant in that area, and what your lived experience isn't something that's accessible to most people. So,
but
I think
he was kind of explained it though, because he's saying that he is experiencing that community aspect vocationally because he's teaching, he's having this impact on young people like constantly, you know, and that's why I was explaining, you know, conversely, since my vocation, I don't have any of such impact that I experience it in my avocational life, you know?
Yeah. Well, it ended up getting kind of fleshed out eventually. I think there's enough there that's...
Are you disappointed, Randy?
I just felt out of control, and I don't like not being in control of something I'm in control of.
You should have sacrificed a lamb, you know, a pure without any speckles before this thing started, because Moloch has not done you any favors.
I kind of like Moloch. Yeah. I'm a 10.
Yeah, you should have gotten laid, in other words.
Yeah. Well, and then it kind of brought out my own frustrations of my inability to find a community for my family, and part of the problem is my career has caused me to move from state to state unexpectedly. I wouldn't have bought a house and built a $100,000 deck in Missouri if I thought I was going to leave in less than a year, you know?
Right.
I was fully invested in Missouri and thought I was going to die there. And, you know, circumstances took me to Denver, and Denver is now more of a, it's more of a secure, I mean, my partners are just wonderful people, so there's no reason for me to leave. And ever since we've been here now a year, and Jen is lonely, and you know, we go to these ex-Mormon things, and they're just not that fulfilling. You know, everyone, it's just basically, let's get drunk and bash on Mormonism, and it's like, God, there's other things to talk about. Like, I do this on the podcast because I feel like it helps people, but I don't want to be that to be part of my social circle. Is that a fair thing to say, or is it?
Well, I mean, for me personally, you remember when I left, I, like, the thing that was amazing to me was that Mormonism shrunk to this provincial little thing, you know, out there, with like really pathetic little, you know, tentacles spread out across the world. And so I just realized, man, there's this huge world. I'm not one of those people who's like, I'll always be a Mormon, you know, and all that sort of stuff. I was like, I'm out of here. There's a big fucking world. And there are all these people, you know, and I don't have to actually think about it. And so when I lived back east for the longest time, 15 years, I didn't even run into a Mormon, let alone, and not even thought about it or anything like that. I was just busy learning shit. And experiencing shit and just living a life. It's only when I moved back to Salt Lake that it came up again. And also when I was dealing with you and your, you know, apostasy.
Apostasy. Yeah, then that's the thing. Both of you guys left young enough where, and both of you
totally cut
went,
it out.
Went off.
Yeah. Cause I had,
well, you went out of the parochial area.
Right.
You know, John went backpacking, and he was staying in hostels. You know?
Yeah.
And he actually finally realized he was gay, and then was able to just run down that flowery meadow, you know, as a free bird. And so, obviously, Mormonism to both you guys was something easy to just let go of. But, you know, when you leave after being like 35 years old, being so into it, it's hard. It's harder. Like, the tentacles are so much deeper in me than they are in you guys.
I also think that there's another thing, is that when you leave, really the only reference point you have for something that deals with the, you know, existential and, you know, what am I doing, all that sort of stuff, is Mormonism. You haven't been trained to look for interesting stuff elsewhere. And so you kind of cobble things together in connection with that. And you stay within the community and all that.
Yeah. So you guys hadn't even really started your education. I mean, right. you both had a BYU education, but, you know, John went off to Michigan in Ann Arbor to do his PhD. You went off to Nashville, Tennessee, to Vanderbilt to pursue. I mean, you guys became really educated after you left the church. And now it's like, when you're this old and you're already done with all of your doctorate shit, you have to be self-didactic or autodidactic, and that's harder to do, right? Especially by the time you have kids, you know, you got a family and a practice.
Yeah, so. But you're clearly still doing all kinds of exploration, and you're still on that path of, even if you're not in that place where when you're 20-year-old, you're so much open to new paths and everything can be re-imprinted, and you have all this flux and potential for metamorphosis and everything like that at a 20-year-old compared to 40-something, you know, where I'm now. And so the same exact way, you know, for me, when I made my shift like 5, 6, 7 years ago, when I kind of almost stopped doing history and kind of switched and tried to, you know, learn an entirely new language of, you know, philosophy and theology and everything like that. That's been, it's an alien language always compared to the natural born language to me of history, right? And so I even have to look at philosophy through the history of philosophy, you know, so...
By the way, that's where I look through philosophy too, is through the history of philosophy. But the thing is, Randy, I mean, in terms of you personally, and many people I know who leave the church later, it isn't like they are anchored to the church. I think that you are anchored somewhat just by the fact that you're doing this podcast, but you're still exploring well out of that sort of domain of like, I'll always be a Mormon, right? And the people that hang around, say, like the Tuscanos or something like that, where, you know, their orbit is still within that sort of cultural place, right? Or Joanna Brooks or whoever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like a Mormon anymore, but I just think about it too goddamn much, and it bugs me. And it doesn't help that I'm an orthodontist, and there's so many goddamn dentists that are Mormons. It's unbelievable. Like 80% of the dentists that refer to me are Mormon.
I told you my cousin is a dentist.
Your cousin is a dentist.
Is a Mormon dentist in Pueblo. In Pueblo, though.
In Pueblo,
where you are.
Where I work. And then we'll after
if you're, listening, hi Josh.
Yeah, right. After talking to you a little bit further, I realized that I couldn't even drop your name. He'd be like, "Who? Your cousin, John Hamer." Oh,
he'd know who I am. I'm the oldest male cousin,
and the tallest.
I'm the tallest cousin,
and the gayest.
Well, there's some other gay cousins.
Are there?
At least one.
Think about it, Jimmy. Mom was one of 10 kids. Like dad's side, fuck it. There was no cousins, no blood cousins. But with mom's side, we have, you know, something like 60 first cousins, and something, you know, if you add second cousins, we're talking well over 100. And I have not heard one single story of a gay cousin.
Yeah, you wouldn't, I don't think, because we don't really actually have much communication. We know nothing about them anyway, let alone whether one of them's gay or closeted gay or something like that. So yeah. I think odds are that there's some stuff.
Well, statistically, there has to be at least 10.
That's kind of...
there's some. You have some. Whether who knows how many.
Yeah, there's got to be somebody. Well, but
I haven't, you know, you would think that doing this podcast, one of the fucking cousins, if one of them has left, you know, would stumble across this and contact me. Every cousin I am in contact with is disturbed by me and disturbed by you.
Yeah. No, they don't like it. We exude something just uncorrelated. And so it's like
every it's time just... we go to a funeral, it's like, oh.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like we are in anyone's face. I mean, we're just like...
Not at all.
As like, you know, namby-pamby as you could get and sweet and nice and talk about USC football or BYU or something like that. But the, you know, it is really interesting that the only the person I know who's LGBT or whatever other letter you want to add to that is my own daughter. And so I guess there is something to that idea that, you know, being pro-gay actually causes people around you to be gay.
It's just you're not in contact with these people. And everybody always tells me they've got these huge Mormon families and all of their cousins are all TBM or whatever. Well, you just don't. You are not in contact with all of those cousins. You don't know all their secrets, all, you know, anyway. So
definitely true.
Yeah, it's totally confirmation bias because the dozen or so cousins that I, you know, no, you know, like they go, "Hey, good to see you, Randy," at a funeral or a family reunion. They're all, you know, just with talking to them within a few minutes, they're all fully, wholly indoctrinated. So yeah, it's confirmation. But I mean, I know Ron's because he was close to my age. You remember Rusty, Jimmy?
Yeah. I always thought he was gay.
He probably was. It was. Is. I mean, when I say was, I mean at the time that we were like...
He was gay. Now he's just SSA.
Yes. John Saber says no.
Yeah.
Like he, you know, he kind of, you know, the message we got from Ron, and was that he went off the deep end. And what really probably happened was that he just, you know, didn't want to go to church anymore.
Yeah, well, you and I technically went off the deep end too.
That's true. So. I forget that. That's probably the narrative that they say.
Yeah, but a lot of cases, a family just won't ever give that message because Mormons love to give only the positive news, you know. And so, if one kid has left the church or whatever, they're not going to put that in the newsletter.
No, it's definitely like one big Facebook community, right? Where everyone burnishes up their image and
you know.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I wanted you to talk about, Jimmy, with like some of the cultural failures of dealing with those questions at the beginning was everyone, like nobody is revealing their true human condition, you know. You go to church and everyone puts on their best face, and everyone looks like they have their shit together. But when you don't have your shit together and you know it, and you go to church and everyone else seems like they have their shit together, that's a horrible community to be in.
Well, it's really stressful to be in that, and also you don't get any sustenance, right? It's not a great place to have things derail, because that's actually one more sign. It's kind of like a prosperity gospel sort of element to Mormonism where, you know, and so it's just a terrible place to not fit in the way that you're, you know, to not have that Facebook image be your reality. And so, yeah, I just don't think it's a very good institution. I don't. I think that it's just not.
It's one of the craziest, you know, dichotomy aspects between, you know, these cousins separated at 1844 is the Community of Christ culture. I always was amazed by how it's all very Eeyore, glasses half empty kind of types. And so everybody is just constantly doing that. And I'm just like, man, if you people would just smile a little bit more about some of this stuff instead of complaining about all of how bad everything is. Actually, we have it pretty good here. You know, then when Mormons come in, they wouldn't think the whole thing is falling apart and, you know, the way they always get. But they come into a Community of Christ and everyone's like, well, I guess the church is destroyed now. You know, it's been a good 180-year run, but now we're done. You know, and we're just constantly doing that. Anyway, so anyway, but it's in some ways, like Jim was pointing out, it's a feature.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So something in between that, you know, where the people who do have their shit together can sucker the ones who don't.
It's what I love about being someone who grew up Mormon, went to Community of Christ, someone who grew up American and moved to Canada, is that I'm in this culture of these people who are just so intensively non-obtrusive and polite. You know, but I grew up in Minnesota, so I'm aware of it, even though I'm not from there either. So anyway, so I am like from Chicago, where I was born. And so I'm way pushier than anybody who's from Canada, you know, but I understand not to be too pushy that they'll be upset. Like if I was from New York, where they would not take it. Right. But they love it. So as a result, and people get along with me really well, but we actually get stuff done. And I really like them because they aren't pushy. You know? Anyway, so the same thing is true for Community of Christ. So anyway, their culture, the Community of Christ culture, is to say, no, we can't possibly do that. No. Oh, how could we do that? No. You know, that kind of thing. And there's no reason to say no. We can always do it. Yes, let's do that, you know? And so I just do it.
How many ways can't we do this?
Right. They're like, we couldn't do that. Anyway, and so then I say, okay, but let's do that. And then I do it. And then there's, oh, okay, well, that was nice that we did that. You know, I mean, anyway. So.
So should we talk about Trump?
Oh, God.
No, let's please. I'm so tired of Trump.
I'm tired of Trump, but I'm not tired of the question. Like, okay.
Hi, this is Pollyanna from Northville, Michigan, and I listen to Infants on Thrones religiously while digging on a Bronze Age archaeological site in Romania. You can comment on this episode on the website infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?